Welcome to MS Explored, the podcast for people living with MS in Ireland. In the very first episode of the series, we will explore the journey from diagnosis through to managing your condition and what the future might hold. I'm Aoife Kerwin, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Laura Lee, who was diagnosed with MS 10 years ago, and Dr. Lisa Costello, consultant neurologist at Beaumont Hospital. Dr. Costello and Laura, thank you so much for joining us today. We're delighted to be able to speak with you both as part of MS Explored, the podcast, and to have the dual perspective of the healthcare professional and the person living with the condition as well. Laura, I'd love to start with you. Could you tell us a little bit about your own journey from diagnosis and how you have adapted to life with MS?
Of course, Aoife. So I was diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS way back in 2012. I actually first became ill in 2010, but the diagnosis took a little while to follow. So kind of depending how you look at the dates, I'm about 10 years into it at this stage. So I mean, I was thinking about my MS journey, and I suppose the best metaphor I could come up with, as obvious as it may seem, is probably that it's been a roller coaster full of ups and downs. I think I'm so far past my diagnosis at this stage that certainly things have kind of leveled out, and my life feels very even keel now. I think my life is probably very typical, what you might imagine for your kind of average 32-year-old. You know, I work full time, I'm engaged, I have two dogs. I you know, I do all of the things that you might expect your normal 32-year-old, whatever normal is, to do. And I suppose for me, I was very young when I was diagnosed. I was 21 when I first became ill. I was 23 when I was diagnosed. So for most of my adult life, you know, this is all I've known. All I've ever known is how to be an adult with MS. So when I think about how I've adapted, maybe I've had to adapt less maybe than if I got my diagnosis later in life, if that makes sense. But yeah, because I think because I was a very young adult, I've kind of emerged into adulthood with my diagnosis. I think it's a funny one thinking about how I've adapted as well, because honestly, I'm not sure it's ever something that I'll be done with. I think having MS is one of those things where you're constantly evolving with it. It's an unpredictable illness. You know, I don't know what the next hour holds for me, never mind the next year or 5 years or 10 years. So it's something that you constantly just kind of have to roll with, go with the flow. And, you know, I think part of kind of adapting to it is accepting that to the extent that you can. It can be difficult. As I said, MS is a really unpredictable illness, and you perhaps don't have as much control over your life as you may like to. So there's definitely learning in terms of the adaptation there. But yeah, I think, you know, in terms of adapting, I think a key thing for me was trying to accept my diagnosis. It wasn't a particularly easy task. And I think, again, it's one of those things that I'll always continue with. I don't think I'll ever be done in fully accepting the diagnosis again, because I don't know what my future holds in terms of my illness. So, you know, whilst I'm very accepting of my life now, there may be work to do that down the line if my life changes very significantly as a result of my illness. But yeah, needless to say, I mean, thinking about the last 10 years, it's definitely been a roller coaster. As I said, lots of ups and downs, but my life is really wonderful in many ways. And the fact that I have MS is part of my life and part of me, but it's not an incredibly defining factor of my life now, certainly. I think it was for a period following my diagnosis, but as I said, things have definitely leveled out, definitely evened out for me, such that, yeah, having MS is one of the many interesting things about me, I would hope.
And Laura, I think that many people would probably be able to relate to that sense of, you know, kind of settling with a diagnosis after some time. It can be difficult to accept that, and that idea as well of kind of having to accept it at various points in time in your life as well, because it may change, your life may change, and you have to just adapt as you go. And Dr. Costello, if I could go to you and just ask, what are the common early signs of MS? What do you see coming into clinic from people who are being newly diagnosed?
Well, MS can cause a myriad of different symptoms, and it's unpredictable, and it's there's no two people living with MS that are identical. So not every patient will experience every symptom. But common presenting symptoms would be symptoms that are attributable to dysfunction of the optic nerve, brain or spinal cord. So in general, we would see patients perhaps with visual disturbance, loss of vision in an eye, or perhaps double vision. Occasionally, people would get problems with their mobility, so difficulty walking associated with weakness, some numbness or pins and needles in the arms or legs. Bladder and bowel dysfunction, it can be quite prominent for some patients. And then fatigue is another common symptom that tends to go with MS, and is, you know, particularly at the time of relapse, can be quite debilitating. So there would be some of the common symptoms we would see, but that's by no means an exclusive or exhaustive list.
Take us through the journey from diagnosis to treatment. What does that look like for somebody who is newly diagnosed with MS?
So for somebody who has an established diagnosis of MS, and as Laura alluded to, it's not always a, you know, a quick and easy one MRI scan and you're done. It can take a period of time and other things need to be excluded. But when the diagnosis of MS is established, I suppose one of the first things we discuss with the patient is what type of MS they have, whether it's a relapsing remitting form or one of the more progressive forms of MS. And that will very much dictate the type of drug treatments that are available. But I suppose in a general sense, the approach would be, first of all, we look at lifestyle factors. So we generally address vitamin D deficiency and put patients on vitamin D supplementation. We look at things like smoking and, you know, general lifestyle issues like a healthy diet and exercise and all of that. So that's an important part of it. And then we look to see, you know, are there any immediate issues that need to be dealt with from a symptomatic point of view? So whether that is pain or spasticity or fatigue, do we need to address any of those issues? Does a person need a course of steroids in the short term to get them over the hump if they've had, you know, a relatively severe relapse? So that would be sort of the short term treatment. And oftentimes it's not just about the doctors, you know, they may need to see a physio or an occupational therapist or a psychologist, or, you know, depending on what the issues are at any given time. And then I suppose we start to think about the medium to long term, and that's really thinking about drugs that will alter the course of the disease over time. So we call these disease modifying therapies, or DMTs for short. And there are a number of factors that we need to consider when we're deciding which drug is right for which patient. You know, so it's very individualized, I would say, and based on several factors.
I suppose that the treatment decision can be quite tricky and is very individual to each person. What advice would you give to anyone who is currently at this stage?
Yeah, so it's a lot of information to take in at the beginning. And I think, you know, we are very cognizant of the fact that people are, you know, still coming to terms with the fact that they've been told they have MS, and now we're asking them to, you know, take on a lot of information. So I think while it is obviously important to make an early diagnosis and start treatment at an early point for many patients, we are aware that, you know, you do need to take the time, I think, as well. This isn't going to be all one conversation. You know, there's things we need to discuss, many things we need to discuss when deciding what DMT to use. And then generally, once we've narrowed it down to one or two agents, we would give the patient some focused information on those, give some written information. The MS nurse would chat with them as well. And then I would generally say, take some time, have a chat, have a read, have a think, discuss with your family. And then you'll have more questions. And then it's often on the second visit that we can kind of get into things in a bit more detail. So I think time and discussion with the doctor and with the nurse is very useful and important, particularly in the beginning when it's all a bit overwhelming.
Absolutely. And Laura, if we could ask for your experience. So going back to diagnosis, can you talk to us a little bit about the time you were diagnosed, you know, what that experience was like for you?
Sure. It was really tough, even that's the first thing that comes to mind. I had been unwell in 2010, but I recovered fully from that period of unwellness, even though I had been extremely ill, was hospitalized, had essentially lost the full function within my body. You know, I was pretty much bedbound. And there were kind of questions at the time around neurological illness within the family. And You know, whether or not MS was specifically mentioned at the time, honestly, I can't remember. I have a feeling it wasn't, but I mean, there is no history of neurological illness within my family. So it just seemed, I mean, completely bizarre that this was even being brought up to me. And of course, you know, I was 21, kind of thought I was invincible. And I was diagnosed at the time with transverse myelitis, which essentially indicated, you know, an area of a significant area of inflammation in my spine, actually. And that was kind of said to be the cause of everything I was experiencing. So I was sent home under the guidance of rest up. Hopefully you will recover fully. You may not, but hopefully you will. So sure enough, I went home and slowly but surely recovered fully over the course of a few months. And honestly, I won't say I ever forgot about that incident, but went on with my life and, you know, finished my degree. I was an undergraduate at the time and, you know, went to working for a year after my undergrad and very much viewed it as a one-off incident. And I was literally then 2 years later at home one evening and started experiencing a lot of the same symptoms that I had done in 2010, which I instantly recognized as being, you know, very similar to what had happened 2 years prior. And my diagnosis followed then. But I mean, even though I had been unwell in 2010, and I think, again, I was hospitalized in 2012, and there was a lot more talk at the time around, you know, something like MS. You know, the doctors were clearly gearing up to give me this diagnosis. But I mean, my world just, I mean, just talk about the rug being pulled out from under you. You know, it was just so profoundly shocking, I think, more than anything else. And I think because it is such an unpredictable illness, you know, I was 23, kind of, I had just started into a PhD, which was already kind of like this new area of transition. I was in a new relationship. You know, there was kind of, I suppose it was a transitional period in my life. And then to get, you know, a huge diagnosis like MS, it just rocked the foundations of my world, really. And I think at the time, I think the community, I would say, the MS community now, I feel, is really vibrant, really large. You know, you can kind of go online and very quickly find a number of different MS communities, whether that's here in Ireland, internationally. And I don't think that was quite the case back in 2012. I certainly didn't feel like it was. So it was very lonely. I didn't know anyone. I'd literally never met anyone in my life who had MS. And I think I knew nothing about the illness. I knew absolutely nothing about it. Kind of just what I was told in hospital at the time, which was very little. You know, as we've already spoken about, you know, it's so overwhelming trying to take in all of the information. So I kind of went home with the diagnosis and not much else, really felt very just incredibly overwhelmed by all of it. And I think felt the need to put on a brave face around all of it, which I think on reflection was probably me trying to protect myself by doing that. But I think, you know, it certainly added a layer of complexity to the entire thing that made it even more difficult. But I mean, there's no two ways about it. It was a really, really difficult period of my life. It was just so incredibly shocking, so out of the blue, and just the future just felt so incredibly uncertain and very scary. And of course, if I knew then what I know now, it would have been a very different situation. But look, hindsight is 2020, as they say. But I do wish I could go back to 2012, Laura, and just, you know, give her a hug and tell her that everything's going to be all right. You know, that the next 10 years aren't actually going to be nearly as bad as I thought they would be. And that actually they would bring, you know, all of the things that I was hoping to have achieved, let's say, in the next 10 years have happened, you know, regardless of the fact that I have this illness. But look, the passage of time needed to happen for all of that to emerge.
Dr. Costello, when somebody comes into clinic and they've been diagnosed with MS, I'm sure you have a lot of questions directed at you. What are some questions that you think are worth asking when somebody's diagnosed with MS?
the questions that people will often ask me at the first visit when a diagnosis is discussed for the first time, and many people will talk about is this going to affect my ability to have a family? Is this something I'm going to pass on to my children? Or is this going to affect my ability to work? There would be kind of common, pretty common questions that we would address. I mean, in terms of what the patients should be asking, I think there's no wrong question, you know. I mean, a lot of things go through your mind, I'm sure, mm-hmm. when you get that type of diagnosis. But I suppose it's often useful to establish what type of MS you have, because that will obviously guide treatment over time. And something else that I suppose would be useful information for you to have from your neurologist would be, how active is my MS? And how, what are the treatment options? There will be, I suppose, the things to get out of a consultation. You know, what is the plan going forward in terms of my treatment options? But I think that, I mean, it's very broad. There's a lot of things that we would discuss, and a lot of things that are important.
Yeah. And of course, any question, as you say, that anybody has, if it's your question, then it's relevant. And, you know, in that moment where somebody's diagnosed with something, there is no wrong question. There is no wrong question to ask. If it matters to you, it's worth asking.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, oftentimes the first question is, what is MS? You know, start at the beginning and go from there. I mean, occasionally people have friends or family or, you know, have some information about it. But a lot of people, like Laura said, it means completely blindsided by this, have no idea what it is. They immediately assume the worst, you know. So I think it's kind of important, I suppose, to start at the beginning and just give a person an understanding of what the disease is, what, you know, what's involved, what are the risk factors. And then I suppose the focus often goes then to treatment and how is it going to affect their life in, you know, a variety of ways.
So, Dr. Costello, when should someone go to their GP about their symptoms?
There's a couple of different things to consider. So I suppose from a medical point of view, we generally say that a relapse is a new symptom or a worsening of an old symptom that comes on and is progressive and persistent over at least 24 hours. And generally, we would say that the first thing to do if you have new persistent neurological symptoms and you have MS will be to exclude an infection. So if you have your urinary tract infection or a cold or COVID in more recent times, any sort of infection can cause a transient worsening of MS symptoms, and we call this a pseudo relapse or a false relapse. And when the infection settles down, the symptoms settle down as well. So generally, if symptoms are persistent and progressive, we would advise that somebody initially goes to their GP and have their temperature checked and just a few basic medical things to make sure that there's no evidence of infection. And if infection is excluded and the symptoms are ongoing, and certainly if they're getting worse, then we would advise that they get in contact or their GP gets in contact with the MS team, because I think any new symptoms should prompt a review. And certainly if symptoms are, you know, very significant, the person may need steroids, or on occasion they may need hospitalization for new symptoms, or they may need to access other services like physiotherapy or other rehabilitative services. And also, if there is a clinical relapse, that should probably prompt updated MRI imaging just to see what's going on and what the state of play is. And if, you know, it may prompt a discussion around change of treatment if the person is on a medication that isn't fully suppressing their disease activity.
Thank you. And I think some people are probably, you know, a little bit confused about what they should go to their GP for and what they should contact their MS nurse for, what they should contact their neurologist about. Can you maybe just chat a little bit about the differences there and where people should direct their issues?
Well, I suppose, I mean, it is often difficult to say exactly who the right person to contact is straight away. But I mean, I think if symptoms are, so people who live with MS, who even when they're well and have no disease activity and are not having a relapse, they may have intermittent symptoms of MS, you know, for example, tingling or pain or bladder overactivity, depending. And these don't necessarily, you know, while they will bring them up at the clinic visits, I suppose a lot of some of those symptoms may be, you know, you could discuss some of them with your GP. If in doubt, I would say get in contact with the MS nurse, particularly if you have a new symptom or you've got a symptom that's getting worse day on day, then that's something I think that should be discussed with the MS team if it's occurring in the absence of an infection. If you have a fever and you feel, you know, fluey, or you have burning, passing urine, probably that will be something more. You could go to your GP, who could just screen you for basic things like a urinary tract infection or, mild viral illness, and could deal with that locally. And you wouldn't necessarily have to come to the MS clinic. But I think the general advice would be, if it's something new or it's something that's getting worse and it's not going away and you're worried, then you should probably get in contact with the MS nurse. And if they can then, I suppose, listen to your story, and they'll have your medical details and know your background and your medications, and they can advise you further. And if they feel it's something that you should initially go and see your GP, they can advise that. And if they're more worried by what they hear on the phone, then they could discuss it with the neurologist and arrange a clinic visit.
And you've mentioned there that there are different types of MS. Would you be able to explain the different types of MS that there are?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, there are three different subtypes of MS. The commonest type is what we call relapsing remitting MS, or MS. And this is characterized by attacks or relapses, where a person develops neurological symptoms that come on usually over a period of days and can last anything from weeks to months. And then following this relapse or attack, the person goes into what we call a remission, which is a period of relative disease quiescence. The person may not have full resolution of the symptoms, but certainly they improve significantly. And then that remission can last for a variable period of time until another attack or relapse occurs. So that's relapsing remitting MS, which is the commonest type of MS. About 85% of patients at diagnosis will receive that diagnosis. Over a period of time, then, some patients who began as relapsing remitting MS will go into what we call the secondary progressive MS phase, which is not characterized by the very dramatic attacks and remissions, but is more so characterized by very slow progression in problems with walking, with or without bladder dysfunction, and perhaps cognitive impairment. So it's a less dramatic relapses, but I suppose more slow burning type of disease course. And then a minority of patients, approximately 10 to 15%, will have a diagnosis of primary progressive MS or PPMS from the outset. And these patients rarely have relapses. And again, their disease course will be more characterized by progressive problems with mobility over time. So there would be the three main subtypes based on the clinical story. You know, I mean, you can't tell what type of MS someone has by looking at their MRI scan or sending off a blood test. I mean, it's completely based on how, you know, what the person's story is. And certainly it may not always be clear in the very beginning what type of MS a person has, and the type of MS they have may change over time as it becomes more clinically apparent or with the passage of time.
And I suppose that makes a difference as well to, you know, when considering what treatment options there are. Laura, if I can go to you, can I ask you, what kind of things did you factor in for yourself when you were making a decision regarding treatment?
I'll be honest with you, Aoife. I didn't have a huge amount of choice with regard to my treatment. I was given two options for DMTs, both very similar, really, in terms of they were both just kind of oral medications. And, you know, the kind of format, you might say, of taking them was fairly similar. So I think it's, you know, and it's kind of a piece of advice I've given to people who have gotten a diagnosis of MS. I think what's really crucial is that whatever DMT you sign up to fits into your life, if that makes sense. So if it's going to be something that you're not willing to engage in systematically, which of course you have to do when it's your DMT, then perhaps it's not the right option for you. But, you know, I know some people don't want to take a pill every day. They would prefer to go and sit in hospital for a transfusion for, you know, maybe a few hours per month or whatever it is, because That's what's easier for them within their lives. Of course, there, you know, as a woman, there are other considerations around starting a family in relation to your MS treatment. And, you know, I think it's something that we need to be thinking about a long time ahead of actually wanting to pursue a family, to kind of give yourself that time if you need to change a treatment, come off a treatment, potentially, that you have the time to kind of get to grips with those decisions and make an informed decision about what's best for you and your life. But I think, you know, we all work with our healthcare teams who know us, I suppose, in the sense that we're their patients, but we might see them maybe once a year, maybe less, and have, you know, a very small amount of time with someone. And I think, you know, obviously we trust our healthcare teams to make recommendations based on what they think is best for us. But we also need to be kind of an active decision maker in relaying to our healthcare teams, you know, what our lives are like and what we'll be happy to incorporate into our own lives and what we feel is the best decision for us. Because, you know, we are experts as MS patients. We are the people living in our bodies and we understand our lives in a way that no one else can. So I suppose for me, I suppose it's something that I would say to people, you know, you have agency and you have autonomy in the decision-making process alongside the expertise and guidance of your healthcare team that you're working with. Yeah, for me, I think it's something that you're going to be willing to actually engage in properly and that you can incorporate into your life in such a way that it, you know, ultimately, your DMT is there to enhance your life. You know, it's there to support you in your illness and to hopefully keep the effects of your MS to the most minimal degree that it can for as long as it possibly can. So if it's something that you're happy to engage in as well, then all the better. My DMT appears to be working quite well for me. And I think that's another point actually as well. You know, for some people, it's not the case that you make a decision around your DMT once and then that's it. You know, you have to review as you go and to assess how well it's working for you over time. So it may be the case, as with lots of things to do with MS, that changes over time, that you feel the efficacy is not what it once was. If your MS is progressing to an extent, then you have to, I think, be willing to think about changing what is no longer working for you.
Yeah. And, you know, our experiences there are so different, Laura, because you've been on one treatment and I've been on multiple treatments, you know. So, but I would echo what you say there as well. It has to fit with your lifestyle. And if it doesn't fit with your lifestyle, you're less likely to be adherent to it. And adherency is key. And Dr. Costello, I might just bring you back in there to maybe talk about the importance of adhering to your medication plan and communicating to your healthcare provider if you're non-adherent for any reason.
Yes, I mean, I'd agree with everything that Laura said. I mean, obviously, adherence to the drugs is key, because if you're not taking the drugs regularly or as prescribed, then the drugs are not going to do what they're supposed to do. I mean, I think it's difficult with any chronic illness where, you know, people find it hard to complete a course of oral antibiotics for an infection. But I mean, I suppose when you have a disease where you have to take medication, you know, in the long term, that's always going to be a challenge. So particularly if people have side effects of the medication, but even if they don't, it's just, you know, with the best will in the world, people can still occasionally forget their meds, particularly if there's you know, a change in the routine for any reason. So I suppose what's important is, you know, you're probably not going to see your neurologist any more than once every 6 months, depending on the center. So, you know, what we don't want to hear is meeting somebody 6 months later and they say, well, I haven't actually been taking that medication since I saw you last because I was having issues with it. I mean, I think, you know, I can't overemphasize the importance of, if you're having a problem with the medication, that's fine. Not every drug suits every person. But I suppose if we don't know about the problem, then we can't address it. And usually, obviously, all of these medications, there's several options. As Laura said, different people are on different things and different patients will be on multiple medications. And many times the medications are stopped because of side effects. It's not always because they're not working. Sometimes it's because they're not tolerated. And we always say to patients, you know, if you can't tolerate the medication, then we'll stop it. And we can talk about what your other options are. But I think it's just, have that line of communication open, and that if you're experiencing difficulties with the medication for whatever reason, that you discuss it with the MS team.
And should somebody wait for their clinic appointment to bring that up, or is that something that they should kind of proactively contact the MS clinic about?
I mean, I think the patients, you know, probably I would recommend you be proactive if it's something that's persistent. You know, I mean, if you had, you know, a lot with some of the medications, you may have some side effects that are more prominent after initiation of the medication. As body gets used to it over time, then the side effects do resolve. So we generally sort of say, you know, give the medication a chance in the very beginning, unless the symptoms are completely intolerable. But if you're having side effects or issues with a medication that are persistent, I don't think I'd wait until the next clinic appointment to highlight that, particularly if you've stopped the medication yourself for that reason. I think it'd be useful to contact the MS nurse or whatever your point of contact is. And it can be discussed, even over the phone initially, rather than, you know, either suffering on and taking it for 6 months when it's not suiting, or just stopping it yourself and being on nothing until you're seen again. So I think, no, I would recommend that if symptoms or side effects of a drug are intolerable and persistent, then to discuss it with the MS team as in a sort of a timely manner.
Dr. Costello, can you talk to us a little bit about the signs of progression in MS?
Yeah, so this is always a slightly difficult one, because progression, I suppose, is something that we usually diagnose in retrospect rather than something that's, you know, immediately obvious at one point in time. So progression is not something that's going to show up on an MRI scan necessarily. So even if, so what clinical progression can represent is when, you know, somebody's MRI scan is not showing any significant changes, but the person's mobility or overall physical functioning is declining over time. And it doesn't happen quickly for the majority of patients. It's something that happens very gradually over years. And there is a sort of a grey period in between where it's a little unclear whether the person is still in a relapsing remitting phase versus a secondary progressive phase in particular. Now, for patients with primary progressive MS, it's slightly different in that they've had disease progression from the onset, and that's, a different type of MS. But for the person with relapsing remitting MS, you can certainly have, you know, short-term deterioration in mobility due to relapses or infection, or certainly, you know, the nature of the illness is quite dynamic and unpredictable and can change over time. But I suppose what progression looks like more is less relapses or very dramatic attacks, and more sort of slowly progressive deterioration in mobility over a period of several years usually. So I think if people are worried about progression, we generally say, well, you know, let's think about what you looked like 6 months ago or 12 months ago. You know, I mean, has your mobility significantly changed in that period of time? You know, try to sort of think of something, you know, a walk to the local shop or a walk to the school, or, you know, something that they do very frequently, and say, well, if you think of yourself this time last year, does that look dramatically different, or, you know, is it more or less the same? And someone who, I suppose, has entered a secondary progressive phase, they would say, well, no, I'm, you know, significantly, it takes me a lot longer to get there now, or I may need to use a walking aid. I mean, there are other aspects of progression. It doesn't necessarily have to be a deterioration in walking. If it can be a deterioration in bladder function, often goes with that, or in cognitive abilities, you know, people just experiencing more brain fog, being less sharp than they had been. But if we have a suspicion for progressive disease, then what's useful, I suppose, is to get objective measures of cognition, mobility, with a physiotherapist or with a psychologist over time, and see if, in addition to a person feeling that there has been progression, that there is an objective decline in function as well. But it can be difficult. It's certainly not something that you'd diagnose on at one time point. It's something that you discuss with a person, and that becomes more obvious as it evolves over time.
And if an individual is concerned that they are progressing, what kind of steps should they take?
Well, I suppose the first thing would be to discuss it with their neurologist. I mean, if a person is deteriorating over a relatively short period of time, it would be important to do updated MRI scans just to make sure that there aren't new lesions or that, you know, there isn't active inflammation that could be contributing to short-term progression, but that might respond to augmenting anti-inflammatory drugs. And then I suppose it would be looking at more objective measures of mobility, getting a physiotherapy assessment potentially, and discussing it with your neurologist. But generally, it's something that, you know, I often say to patients, well, I would wonder about disease progression, but I mean, let's, you know, I'm not going to say you definitely have secondary progressive MS today, but I suppose it's a possibility. And, you know, that will become more obvious over time. And let's see how you go over the next 6 months and maybe get a physio assessment and do some objective measures and then talk about it again. It's slightly difficult in that often patients, you know, with relapsing remitting MS get, as Laura will know, periodic MRI scans, and, you know, you'll be told that the MRI is stable or the MRI shows new lesions or is active, and that would sort of prompt a change in treatment potentially. But with disease progression, it doesn't necessarily show up on the test like MRI. So it's more observing the person physically and, I suppose, listening to their story and trying to get a sense in a practical way as to has there been, you know, a definite change over the last 12 or 24 months.
And Laura, I might just come back to you now. You mentioned earlier on that, you know, when you were first diagnosed, the MS community didn't seem quite as large and vibrant as it is now. Can I ask you, what is the best piece of advice that you've been given, or, you know, that you've heard kind of within the MS community, I suppose, that's kind of been helpful to you?
Sure, Aoife. Actually, something that really springs to mind is a piece of advice that my very wonderful GP gave me. I went to see him not long after my diagnosis, and he said, Laura, going forward, you can blame everything that's ever medically wrong with you on the fact that you have MS, or you cannot do that. And it really, I think, kind of characterizes my approach to my MS. Of course, I'm very conscious of the fact that I have MS. You know, it's not something that you can ever forget about. But for me, I just try to approach my life, and if ever there is anything wrong with me medically, in the way that I don't automatically assume that it's that this is a presentation of my MS, or that I'm having a relapse. And I think it's really easy to get into that kind of catastrophic thinking very quickly, especially when you've been very sick, when you've seen what your MS can do to you. There's always that kind of niggle in the back of your mind that at any given moment, something inside your body can just, you know, a switch gets flicked and you're back to that point. So for me, I just tried to not make that assumption. And for me, it's a case, and again, I speak very personally, I think it would create a kind of a cumulative burden for me that would feel very overwhelming. And I think so much about MS, as we've said so many times, it's an unpredictable illness. It can manifest in so many different ways that I think it would be very, very easy to pin any problem you ever had on your MS. And for me, I don't feel like I'm doing myself any favors in doing that, because you may not be ultimately getting to the actual root cause of an issue when you go, oh, well, I have MS, and, you know, the symptoms are so wide ranging. So it's just probably that. And it takes effort. It definitely takes effort, because there's so much uncertainty that comes with life with MS. And for me, I've had to try to work really hard to get more comfortable living in that uncertainty. And for me, it's just really important that MS does not become the one-stop shop for all of my life's problems, be they medical or otherwise. You know, if we met many years ago, and I know I've shared it with you before, I read one of your blogs that you had written, and in it, you were just talking about your life. You were talking about college. You mentioned your age. I knew we were about the same age. Our lives seemed very similar. And you were just a very typical young woman going about her business and happened to have MS. And it had such a profound impact on me. And in a time of my life where I felt really lonely, despite having all of these people around me who loved me and wanted to be there for me, it was a very lonely experience. And just knowing that there was someone else out there like me and whose life was something I could recognize was just really, really impactful. And just seeing, you know, lots of people like ourselves all over the world living their lives with MS and the ups and downs and everything that it brings has just been a real source of comfort over the years. And I'm sure will continue to be as well.
Yeah, I know. I have to say, Lauren, I completely agree. And I, you know, when I was diagnosed with MS, I didn't know anybody who, actually, that's not true. I knew one person who had MS, but they were much older than me. I didn't know anybody who was young and had MS. And, you know, that was why I started to blog for MS Ireland, because I said, oh, well, you know, if I'm a young person with MS, there's probably other young people with MS, but we just don't know about each other. So, you know, that was a really, but it was a great thing for me to do as well, because I needed to channel the energy that I had around diagnosis and around the fact that I was now living with MS somewhere positive. I needed that. So, like, definitely, it's really, really very lovely to hear that that was beneficial for you, but it was also very beneficial for me to share that. So thank you. And I think that's something that, like, a lot of people don't really consider. And Dr. Costello, can I ask, what kind of supports do you direct people to when they're diagnosed with MS or throughout their MS journey?
Well, I suppose the initial person they're introduced to in the clinic and when the diagnosis is established would be the MS nurse. And, you know, he or she is a key link person between the person with MS and the neurologist. So if there are new symptoms or, as we said, issues with medications, the MS nurse is a useful person to reach out to and to get some advice, but also, I suppose, to link into the wider multidisciplinary group if other services need to be accessed at any given time. As you've alluded to, I mean, organisations like MS Ireland, I think, are invaluable in doing just what you've both just been speaking about, I suppose, putting people in touch with their peers, with other people with the lived experience of MS, who can give sort of very pragmatic advice, or even without giving advice, just speaking to somebody who's in the same boat, I think is very therapeutic and very useful, and all the resources that MS Ireland provide. And then there are other online resources and blogs that we can recommend as well. The Barts MS blog in London is very informative on, you know, it's quite scientific and has a lot of information basically on drugs and trials and updates and things like that. So there would be the sort of initial resources that we would point people in the direction of. But then it will very much depend on the person, you know, if depending on what issues they or problems they have at any given time, they may need, you know, to be referred to a psychologist or to be referred for some rehabilitation or to be referred to a urologist or for an exercise program for fatigue. I mean, it very much depends, I suppose, on what the issues are at any given time. But in a broad sense, that will be the kind of things we would speak about, I suppose, initially anyway.
And can I ask, in your time as a neurologist, so myself and Laura, I think, have both kind of, you know, mentioned there how we've kind of seen a change in the MS community, even since diagnosis for us, which is what, around 10 years ago for us. What kind of changes have you seen, have you witnessed in the MS community in that time?
So I suppose I've been an MS neurologist for 10 years and a general neurologist for longer. I would say that the numbers of patients we're seeing with MS are increasing all the time, and that's likely multifactorial, whether it's increased public awareness or awareness from GPs, but also I think access to MRIs, you know, has led to earlier diagnosis. Many people come now with an MRI that's been organized, you know, in the community by their GP. And really, I suppose it's an illness which really had, the landscape has really changed in terms of therapeutics, even since I qualified as a doctor. It's one of those areas which there's really been an explosion in research, translational research. So scientific endeavours have translated into more targeted, more effective drugs for MS patients. So it's one of those areas in neurology that is very satisfying to work in for that reason, because we have lots of options for people. And if option A doesn't work, then, you know, there's option B and C and D, and we can very much more tailor drugs to a person's individual lifestyle preference, rather than just having the one or two one size fits all approach that would have been the case 30 years ago. So there's a lot to be done more. I mean, there's obviously still gaps in knowledge. We still don't fully understand what causes MS. There is, you know, we still don't have a cure for MS, and we still don't have very effective drugs for progressive MS. So I think there's still a huge amount of work to be done in terms of research and treatment. But I think compared to where we were previously, the future looks bright.
That's great to hear. Absolutely. And thank you. Thank you so much for that. As a person living with MS, it's always nice to hear that the future is bright, you know, and certainly, as I say, since my diagnosis, there's been massive change both in the community, but even in terms of the number of treatments that have become available and, you know, how people are approaching managing their own condition in different ways. And, you know, aside from treatment, what other things can people do to help themselves with MS?
It's well proven that a healthy diet, not smoking, drinking in moderation, and being physically as active as you can is good for MS, as it is for most other conditions as well. And certainly for, you know, for certain symptoms like fatigue, paradoxically, you know, being active can be very helpful with that.
And in terms of the vitamin D part of it then that you've mentioned, is that as simple as going in and getting vitamin D supplements in a pharmacy, or should people be having vitamin D levels measured to establish what dosage they might need?
So generally, we would send off a vitamin D level around the time that somebody's being worked up for MS. In my experience, most Irish people or most people living here have low vitamin D. Even if you spend, you know, time abroad in the summer, something that's not going to keep you going for the whole dark Irish winter. So, I mean, most levels are low anyway. Practices vary, but I generally would prescribe a dose of vitamin D that's probably higher than what you might get over the counter. But I think it's worth, you know, obviously over the counter is a good place to start. But I think I would, you know, probably is worth checking your vitamin D at baseline and then discussing with neurologist what dose of vitamin D you should take.
Thanks, Dr. Costello. So, Laura, if I could ask you, is there anything that you expected to change after your diagnosis that didn't?
Yes, 100%. It's funny to think about it now. I remember just feeling that life could potentially change as a whole, you know, that all aspects of my life could potentially be affected by my diagnosis and how my illness was going to progress. You know, I think, as I've mentioned, I had just started a PhD, and I remember being terrified that I wasn't going to be able to finish it. You know, you kind of you feel like you have a fairly big mountain to climb, I think, anyway, when you start a PhD, and to get a diagnosis of MS just made things 100 times more difficult. And, you know, the reality is that I did finish it and it was all okay. I remember being afraid that I wouldn't be able to work, you know, and I work full time in a job that I really enjoy in a very supportive environment. I think a key thing for me, I was afraid that people would be really judgmental about the fact that I had MS, and that hasn't been the case at all. I think, you know, in the course of the last 10 or so years, I think off the top of my head, I've met one person whose reaction maybe wasn't ideal, I'll put it that way. But I mean, you know, people's response has just been wholly, wholly positive. And I think that's been the case for lots of people that I know with MS. And I think as public awareness and education around MS increases, I hope that will, you know, really be the case for people who are diagnosed now and into the future. I think even 10 years ago when I was diagnosed, it was such a mysterious thing. So little was known about it. And the immediate thought was, you know, really negative, that you were only going to progress in one direction, and that direction was going to lead you to severe disability. And I mean, you know, we know now that that's so not the case for so many people with MS. There are so many treatment options. I mean, you know, as Lisa has spoken about, the developments over time in terms of, you know, the medical and general scientific advancements in the MS world are just astounding. And we can hope that that's only going to continue. And I suppose the main thing that I was expecting to change was that, you know, my MS was going to deteriorate and that my life as I knew it was going to be unrecognizable. And again, you know, I'm incredibly fortunate that that hasn't happened. I do everything now that I want to be able to do. There are no aspects of my life where I feel my MS is holding me back. You know, is life made a little bit different sometimes by the fact that I have MS? Yeah, of course. Do I have to be a little bit more flexible around things sometimes? Yeah, absolutely. But as I've said, you know, it's my life. I was diagnosed as a very young adult. This is all I've known. And, you know, ultimately, I live a very happy, very fulfilled life. And the fact that I have MS is part of that, sure. But it kind of, it's not the defining feature of my life or the thing that I allow to kind of make my decisions for me. Does it get factored into things? Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a sensible approach to do that. But yeah, if I could go back, as I said, to Laura of 2012 and tell her that, you know, things were going to work out and actually work out really well, maybe in some ways even better than I had hoped for then I would love to be able to do that, because I think I was so fearful, so uncertain. And look, as I said, sometimes there's nothing for it but to go through it. Yes. You know, I don't think a diagnosis of MS is ever easy for anyone, but yeah, there's an awful lot that I expected to change in, I think, a negative way that absolutely did not.
And Laura, I think that that's it's wonderful that you didn't allow MS to limit you either. I think that was a mistake that I made when I was initially diagnosed, because I remember just being so terrified of what could happen. And I had a little boy as well before I was diagnosed. And it just multiplied the fear in me of what could happen and who would take care of him if I wasn't able to, you know, get up to make him breakfast and this kind of thing. And I remember after my diagnosis, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd do like a full body scan of, are my toes moving? Can I feel my fingertips? All this kind of thing. I had myself gone crazy with this kind of stuff. And it happened at such a strange time for me as well, because I was just finishing my undergrad and I was planning to go on and be a secondary school teacher, and I'd studied art, but I had optic neuritis, and so I had 98% vision loss in one eye, and I went into this future planning mode and immediately thought to myself, well, there's no point in doing that because, you know, I don't think, you know, it'd be a very stable career move to make for me to be an art teacher if there's potential that I might not be able to see. And 10 years later, I've perfect vision. You know what I mean? Now, I'm not saying that I would change some of the decisions that I've made. I, like you, Laura, have a very happy life. I'm very settled in myself. I'm very happy to be where I am at in my life. But like you, I would love to go back and just give myself a little shake. You're going back with compassion and I'm going back with a bit of reality for myself.
Oh, I understand what you're saying, Eva, but look, you're making decisions based on what you know in the moment. And, you know, as I've said many times in our chat today, hindsight is wonderful, you know, and teaches us a lot. Look, you make your decisions based on the resources that you have and the experience that you have available to you in the moment. And look, I think we could all do with giving ourselves a little bit more compassion. We're dealing with a lot and doing the best we can. So the Aoife's and the Laura's of, you know, the many moons ago, I'm sure did their best as well.
That's it. Absolutely. Laura, how did the diagnosis affect your mental health?
Honestly, in the period immediately following my diagnosis, I think I can say on reflection that it had a tremendous impact on my mental health. I was terrified of what my future was going to hold, of what my life would look like, of how my illness was going to progress and the impact that that would have on all the things I held dear in my life. I also felt really angry. I just felt like it was really unfair. I didn't feel like I deserved to receive this diagnosis. Not that anyone ever deserves a health diagnosis of any form, but, you know, that was just how I felt. I felt really angry. I felt really, honestly, very betrayed by my body. I felt like it was out to get me, kind of, if that makes sense. And that was really, really hard to come to terms with. So I think there was definitely a period of time, and I would say, honestly, it was quite a lengthy period. I think kind of the 2 years actually following my diagnosis, I really struggled. I think I, as I mentioned before as well, I think I tried to put on a really brave face. So I don't think I reached out for support in the way that I wish I had, because people were there for me. People wanted to be there for me. And I just really felt the need to kind of motor on, get on with things, and just kind of pretend that everything was okay when it really wasn't. And I think another thing that I really struggled with was I had been a fan of control in my life, to the extent that anyone can have total control over their life. And when you get told that you have MS, that just, I mean, that goes out the window. And I felt like my life was just completely out of control. And that was really, really hard. And I think subsequently, I have, you know, my mental health is not at all what it used to be. You know, I live a very content life now, and I've really come to terms with my diagnosis, but that it took time. And, you know, I think a turning point for me actually was perhaps ironically enough when I started to be much more open with people about the fact that I had MS, and I didn't feel like I was carrying this really big secret around on my back, and felt much less burdened by it, and really relished being open with people about the fact that I have MS. And, you know, it's an approach I still take now. You know, here I am speaking to the world about the fact that I have MS. I mean, if you had told me 10 years ago that I would do this, I would have, you know, collapsed with shock. But it's been a really wonderful experience for me to share my own experience and my life with MS, and to get to connect with community and to get feedback from other people with MS that, you know, hearing my story has helped them in some way. But I think, look, it's one of those things. You know, I think about the fact that I have MS every day. You know, it's kind of always there in the background. And, you know, it comes into my life in kind of expected and unexpected ways. And I find myself kind of thinking things sometimes where I'm kind of, I suppose, a bit shocked that I'm even actually thinking it, because it's kind of like it comes in unconsciously almost. You know, when we bought our house, we live in a cottage that's all one level. And I remember thinking, just having a little chat inside my own head, thinking, oh, you know, if ever my mobility is really affected, like, it's great that the house is all on one floor, so I won't have to try and manage stairs. You know, and we were supposed to get married a few months ago, but COVID kind of scuppered our plans a little bit. So we'll be getting married next year instead, all going well. And, you know, I kind of find myself daydreaming about the wedding. And sometimes those daydreams involve me having a relapse just before the wedding. And, you know, it features in my thinking, certainly. But it's, as I've said before, it's one part of my life now that I have tried really hard to accept and continue to try really hard to accept in whatever way it will show up in my life moving forward. You know, I've a lot of life left to live and who knows what the future holds. But, you know, I think ultimately maintaining a positive outlook is really important for me in terms of my management of my illness. And I suppose taking things for what they are, you know, and taking kind of, I suppose, a mindful approach to my life, whereby, you know, the reality of my life now is that, you know, MS does not hinder me from doing the things that I want to do. And that's what I really try and focus on. And as I've said, who knows what the future holds, but, you know, I hope that I'll have developed enough resilience and kind of grit to deal with whatever my life throws at me, including whatever my MS throws at me.
Thanks, Laura. And, you know, I can absolutely relate to many of the things that you've said there, and particularly in relation to being able to take some positives from it. So while having MS is not positive, there are positive experiences that you can take from it. And I think that part of, for me anyway, part of kind of living with MS and adapting to life with MS is trying to find those positive things that aren't often difficult to find, to be fair. Sometimes, you know, they're very obvious, and really using those, you know, and really remembering the positive parts of it, and, you know, the various experiences and different people that you meet, and the different, you know, the different experience that you have that you never would have had you not been diagnosed with MS. So it's not always negative, and there are definitely positive things that you can take from it.
I want to thank Dr. Costello and Laura for joining us today for the first episode of MS Explored, the podcast. If you want further information on any of the topics discussed today, then please do check out the episode description for links to supports and services. Thank you for listening to MS Explored. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share.